Sindhubhyeva cha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Mukham Karoti Vachalam Pangulangayate Girim Yakripa Tamaham Vande Sri Guru Dinatarinam. Sri Krishna Chaitana Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasari Gaur Bhaktivinoda. So there's a thought I had that I wanted to discuss. Because a lot of times what happens is we get an instruction to do something. And we say, well, how do I do it? You ever have that question? Okay, I heard I'm supposed to do this, but I find it difficult. How do I do it? Sometimes it's true that we don't know how to do it and we need to learn a process or step-by-step formula. And sometimes we just have to do it. There's nothing to learn. It's just our own willpower. It's our own desire. It's our own decision. So I just wanted to talk about that a little bit. Because what happens often is we sometimes come up against an obstacle or a problem. Either an attachment that we're having a difficult time giving up, or perhaps something we should be doing that we're reluctant to do. We procrastinate, or we just feel uncomfortable or fearful. Afraid if we do that, perhaps we'll be unhappy, or it will cause us some pain, so we don't do it. And oftentimes, even though we don't do it, we're not happy, or we may even be miserable because we're not doing it. We know we should. And then we get caught in this paradigm of, how do I do it? What's stopping me? And sometimes, not in every situation, but in some situations, there is actually nothing stopping us other than our own reluctance to do it. It's not like we have to learn a process. Sometimes we come across an obstacle and we think it's too difficult to overcome. So we shy away from it. But actually, if we faced it or we went forward, in many cases, we could overcome it. If you look at the instructions of our scripture and you look at the instructions, many of the instructions that Prabhupada has given, you will see that often the instruction is just, here's the instruction and go do it. That's all it is. It's nothing more than that. Here's the instruction and do it. It's not, how do you do it? It's just, do it. And so what that reveals to us is that certain instructions are simply a matter of our own willpower, of our own desire, our own decision. So this is what I'm going to do. But just like we give an example, simple example. Someone will say, how do I get up early? You just do it. How else can you do it? How else do you get up early? Other than you make a decision and you do it. Of course, you could say, I'll call my friend, they'll wake me up. I'll get an extra alarm clock. You could make those provisions, but even that may not work. Your friend calls you, thank you. You can put the phone down and go back to sleep if you don't have a strong enough desire, right? It's very possible. But when a devotee makes a decision that this is what I want to do, I'm going to do it, it's the right thing, it will be helpful, it's necessary, somehow or other, we come to a point and we say, yes, I'm going to do this. That's when it happens. Isn't it a fact? If you've noticed any change in your life, what was the cause of the change? Ultimately, it was your decision. I mean, that decision may have evolved from your practice. It may have taken you years to make that decision. But the decision itself just took a moment, right? You made the decision. Okay, years of practice to bring yourself to that decision. It may have not been necessary to wait years to make that decision, but perhaps you weren't ready. But you could have made the decision. Maybe you thought you couldn't have made it. But oftentimes, We can, and that's my point. That sometimes we become our our own worst enemy when we think, no, I can't do this. It's too big of an obstacle. I can't overcome this. When in fact we can. And when in fact, if you look at the instructions that we're often given, the instructions sometimes seem to defy what is possible. And Prabhupada would often ask us to do things which defy what is possible. I mean, even to ask a young man born in America to become a brahmachari defies logic. It doesn't really make sense that any man born in America could be a brahmachari, especially those who were not raised or trained that way, which is most everybody. But somehow or other, people came to ISKCON, they understood the philosophy, and they decided, this is what I'm going to do. And they moved in the temple. Some people actually moved into the temple for the first time they went to the temple. They liked it so much, they said, this is it, and joined. And so on the spot, they made a decision. That just shows the power of decision. This is it, I want to dedicate my life. The inspiration was there. And they did it. So my point is that we shouldn't underestimate the power of a decision. We shouldn't underestimate the power of our own willpower, and we shouldn't underestimate the freedom that we have been given by Krishna to make these choices. Because sometimes it doesn't feel like we have the freedom to choose. If we're strongly under the influence of the modes of nature, we lose a bit of that freedom. And the lower down in the modes we go, the more we lose that freedom. And so if we're battling with the mode of ignorance, we have very little freedom of choice now. It's predominated by ignorance. But how do we get into the mode of ignorance? There had to be some choice, some decisions about how we're going to act, what we're going to believe, what we're going to eat, and so forth, that is putting us in the mode of ignorance. And that, then the mode of ignorance, it works on us. So it's not that we don't, it's an accident, or we're totally helpless in these. Even though Krishna says we're forced to act by the modes of nature, but there is choice there of what mode we ended up in. And then also, from the modes of nature, as we're saying, people get out of the modes of nature. People come to Krishna consciousness. They exert their free will. I'm going to serve Krishna. So often when you're thinking of something you should do and you're having difficulty doing it, then you ask yourself the question, or you tell yourself, this is difficult, I don't think I can do it, or you ask yourself, how can I do it? Consider whether you can just do it, that there's no other process. Sometimes, or often, devotees ask, well, how do I control my mind when I chant? And the simple answer is, if you don't control your mind, who's going to control it? And so that can be the answer to so many questions. How do I do this? If you don't do it, who's going to do it? Someone's going to do it for you? So sometimes we may be thinking, well, perhaps by the mercy of my guru, it'll happen, or by the mercy of Krishna, it'll happen. And until I get the mercy, it won't happen. So that's another thought. There is some truth to that, but not entirely. Because it requires our effort to get Krishna's mercy. So it won't come. Mercy never comes without the effort. Now the mercy will allow us to overcome things which maybe by our own efforts we would not be able to overcome. But it's the effort that invokes the mercy that enables us to overcome it. So if we sit back and think, well, I'll continue the process, someday I'll get the mercy, and then I'll be able to overcome all these problems or do all these things which I thought were difficult. That's not completely right. It's right a little bit, but it requires initiative now. Otherwise, what we do is we disempower ourselves and say, well, no, I can't do this. Now, in some situations, that may be true. It may require your whole life to come to the stage, for example, where you could chant the name purely. You can't just do that tomorrow. But in the process of chanting more purely, there are things that we do have control of that often we think we don't have control of. And sometimes we give in to those things because we think we can't control them. We don't have a choice. And the reason we think we don't have a choice is because we give in to them. And when we give into them, they control us. And then we think, there's nothing I can do. I'm controlled by this desire. But the reality is that oftentimes we're giving into it. If this were, if this were not true, then Prabhupada could not initiate anybody. Because nobody could make a vow. Because we could say, I'm not entirely in control of myself, so how can I make a vow to follow four regular principles? But the fact that we do make a vow means we have that much control to choose the right thing, to control ourselves, to not give in to the desires, to be tolerant of our mind and senses. So whenever we say, I can't tolerate this, or I can't control this, or this is too difficult to deal with, or I'm afraid to do this, how do I deal with it? Ask yourself if the answer is, just do it. And often you'll find that's the answer. And everything else will often just be a rationalization, which may stem from a lack of trust in your own ability, a lack of trust in Krishna. It may stem from fear. It may stem from laziness. It may stem from a lack of intention. You look at your life. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Let's look at our lives. And in our lives, all of us have been in situations where we've overcome obstacles, overcome some difficult situation. Everyone's been in those situations. And sometimes I'm sure you've overcome some situation and you look back at it and you thought, I don't know how I did that. That was so difficult and I did it. I stayed up all night for 3 nights. I didn't eat for 2 days. I worked, 36 hours straight and I accomplished this. I don't know how I did it. In every one of those situations, obviously there was something driving us to do that, something extremely important that had to be done, that was necessary, that was pushing us. I've seen this in installations of deities where we're preparing to install the deities and the time is limited and then devotees are making sacrifices, staying up all night, working around the clock. I've seen this in the early days of the movement when devotees were putting on Rath Yatra festivals. They only allowed 2 weeks where they needed more like 5 or 6. And devotees were sleeping 2, 3, 4 hours a night for 2 weeks and working beyond their normal capacity. One devotee said, one senior devotee in our movement, he said, when I look back at the service that I did when Prabhupada was alive, he said, sometimes I'm astonished that I did what I did. So when there's a mission or a purpose or a need that's really, really important, what happens to us? All of a sudden, the things that we might normally say, no, I can't do this, we do them. And we don't even think that we can't do them because they have to be done. You know, when you have a choice whether to do it, well, if it doesn't really matter so much if I do it or not, you might say, I can't do it for whatever reason. Well, you don't have a choice. You just do it. You don't think. You can't think. Let's say a loved one or a close friend is in danger. You can't think whether or not you can help them. You do whatever you can to help. So we do have this experience in our lives that many times we do things because they have to be done and we don't know how to do them. We just do them. So I think there are many things that we have to look at in our own lives as devotees, where we may tend to think, I can't do this, it's too difficult, I'm afraid to do it, I don't know if I can do it, I don't know how to do it, it seems impossible to do, I don't think I can. And question, can I actually do it by simply making the determined effort, the decision to do it? Last night, when we were talking about anger, and I was saying that sometimes controlling anger is just a decision. Sometimes becoming more tolerant is just a decision. I'm going to be more tolerant. Something happens in your life and you make a decision. I need to be more tolerant. I'm not treating people properly because I'm becoming intolerant with their faults, or I'm becoming intolerant with their discrepancies in their activities or their actions or their incompetence. And then you make a decision. This is not the right way to deal with people. So I'm going to be more tolerant. Or I'm not going to be angry. Or as a student, you may not be doing well and you may make a decision. No, I'm going to apply myself. I'm going to be a better student than I was last year. Or I'm going to learn something. There's so many times we make decisions that affect, that greatly alter the way we deal with life. And it was just a decision at some point, this is what I'm going to do. How do we become more tolerant? Well, what ultimately is the answer? How do we become more tolerant? There was in Juhu, I don't know if you know this, in the early days of Juhu, when the devotees got the property, there were flats all over the property, and according to Indian law, people had a right to live there, even though we owned them. So we built a temple in this, what you might call a subdivision, with all these flats. And so they're hearing kirtan in the morning. You know, they weren't expecting that. And so at one point, some people were complaining. I don't know if they were legally trying to stop it. But there was a lecture in which Prabhupada said that we're doing kirtan. We're chanting the names of God, and these people are saying this is a nuisance. Chanting the name of God is a nuisance. And so Prabhupada said, so what can we do? He said, we just have to tolerate it. We just have to tolerate that this is how people are thinking. They're complaining about kirtan. In the holy land of India, the Indians are complaining about kirtan. What to do? Tolerate. And so when you consider what is tolerant, what does it mean to tolerate? You say, how do I tolerate? What's the process to tolerate? What are the six steps for tolerance? You realize, what does it mean to tolerate? It means tolerate. How do you tolerate? You just tolerate. Isn't it? Why don't you come in, sit over here. In case anyone else comes in, they won't have to walk over you. One of the things we also have to tolerate is our own senses. How do you tolerate your own senses? We had this example when Prabhupada was asked about people who've taken initiation and who are not following their vows. He said something very heavy. He said, if you make a promise and you don't follow it, you're not even a gentleman, what to speak of a devotee. So because a gentleman will keep his promise. So how do you keep your promise when circumstances present themselves to you in a way that you no longer want to keep it, or it becomes difficult to keep it, becomes inconvenient to keep it? How do you do it? Well, if you're a gentleman, you've made the promise, what do? You just do it. What's the process? The process is you just do it. Right? So you find yourself becoming weak. What do? You don't give in to the weakness because you've made a promise. How do you not give in to the weakness? You just don't give in to it. When you make that determination, what happens? Krishna gives you the intelligence how to do that. Right? Isn't that the Dhammi Buddha Yogam Tam? Isn't that what it means? It's okay. Isn't that what it means? I give the intelligence. Who does Krishna give the intelligence to? Well, he gives the intelligence to everybody. But what kind of intelligence does he give? The kind of intelligence that the people want according to what their desire is. So, just like Krishna says, when a person wants to worship the demigods, I make their faith steady. He says that in the... What chapter is that in? Tastha Rita Jnana, 7th chapter? I make their faith steady. So, when we make a decision, then where does that determination come from? Where does that power come from? That's Krishna reciprocating with our intention, with our desire. So Prabhupada was very... If you read anything that Prabhupada said about vows, you'll see he didn't compromise at all. No matter what anybody said, I'm weak, it's difficult, whatever the reason was, he said, you promised. That was his reply. A gentleman keeps his promise. Inherent within that reply is the very point we're making. You promised, okay, you can do it. You're weak, okay, I'm feeling weak, what do? I do something about it. Right? That's what Prabhupada expected. You keep your promise. There's a nice story. I like this story very much. I've told it before. But I don't think you've heard it, so I'll tell you. There was a man in Mauritius where I spent about 3.5 years who donated land to the devotees. When Prabhupada came to Mauritius, he was the main host for Prabhupada. So he practically spent, as far as I know, as much time with Prabhupada as anyone. And he was an important man in the government, and Prabhupada asked him to help us. Because he knew that this man, because he was well connected, he could help us in so many ways, get things we needed, pull strings with the government, help us get visas, so forth. So the interesting thing about this man was an Iyer Samajist. And Iyer Samajists are impersonalists. They don't believe in the deity. But he was so inspired by Prabhupada that when Prabhupada asked him to help us, he agreed. He said, yes, I'll help you. He's an Iyer Samajist. So, you know, it's really in many ways very much against what Vaishnavism is. You don't find Iyer Samajis joining ISKCON, I don't think. It's not my experience. Just coming in the temple, seeing the deity, they can't relate to the deity. But anyway, over the years, he helped us in many ways. And in the immature stages of ISKCON, when we devotees were young, we would make mistakes and we would do things wrong. And he would help us rectify them. So once we were talking with him, a number of devotees, we were talking with him, and the conversation came, I don't know exactly how it came up to this topic of all the things that we did wrong. And he was a little upset. You say, you know, you've done so many wrong things, and I've helped you out every time. Then he stopped. He said, I don't know why I continue to do this. He said, because some things you've done are so bad or so wrong, I shouldn't keep helping you. And then he stopped and he said, but your Prabhupada, he told me to help you. And that's why I keep helping you. I promised him. So when I reflect on that, I see that's what a promise means. In other words, he had reasons not to help us. He was an Arya Samajis. And we did things that kind of cracked his faith in us, you could say, as young devotees. We did stupid things. Maybe things which weren't so straightforward. Maybe we upset people. I don't remember. But he had reason not to help us. And he said, I don't know why I help you. Or he said, I shouldn't continue to help you. But your Prabhupada asked me, so therefore I do it. So that's what it means to be a man of your word. You don't even feel like doing it. You have reasons not to do it. It was difficult for him to do it. He gave us land. He had to put it in his will. He couldn't donate it because his wife wouldn't sign for it. And she didn't know he donated in his will. He was helping us that much because Prabhupada asked him. So I think it's a good example of the power of a promise, that if we make it, even despite difficulties, we do it. We don't want to, but we do it because we make a decision, I'm going to do it. And I think it's important for us as devotees to not doubt whether we will follow through on any decision we make, but rather assert to ourselves that I've made these promises, I will do it. Because a lot of times we may think, I don't know if I'm going to do this. I don't know. Maybe I'll slip. Maybe I'll fall. And we're putting in some kind of doubt and something negative in our mind. But it's better to reaffirm to ourselves, I made this promise, I will do it. Or I'm dealing with an obstacle, I'm dealing with a difficult situation, I will deal with it by Krishna's mercy, by the power of the holy name, by the mercy of my guru, I will be successful. Now you might say, but isn't that being proud? Wouldn't that be proud for a devotee to say, I will be successful? I will do this. Does it seem like pride? Oh, look at so-and-so Prabhu. He said he's going to do this. He's proud. Who does he think he is? He's puffed up. He said he's going to be Krishna conscious in this life. He's puffed up. Throw him out of the temple. We don't want to see his face. It's not exactly like that. What it is, it's a commitment to do the right thing based on the confidence that I have the process, I have the holy name, I have the Sangha, I have the Kripa of Guru, Sadhu, Krishna, Mahaprabhu. I have all these things. And therefore, what the devotee is saying is, I will take these things. And by taking these things, I know, or I will be empowered to be successful in my commitments, in my Krishna consciousness, that I will traverse the path. And whatever difficulties I encounter, I will overcome them by mercy of Guru, Krishna, Sangha, the holy name, by taking to the process properly. So this is the proper attitude. Otherwise, often we get into the negative attitude. I don't know. Maybe I won't make it. Maybe I won't be sincere. Maybe I won't be determined. All the negatives. And that's not a healthy way to think. So this attitude is confirmed in the verse by the Avanti Brahman, and he said, Aham Tarishyami Daranta Tamo. I will cross over the ocean of material existence. He said that. Sounds, you know, look at this devotee. Who's he? He said, I will cross over Maya. Do you imagine? You know, you're talking to some devotee and says, I will cross over Maya. I will cross over the ocean of nescience. It's not normally how we behave with one another. But this devotee is saying that, and he's saying, yes, I will do it. But what he's saying is, I have the determination. I'm making a decision to do this. But because it's been done in the past by other great devotees, if I follow in their footsteps, then I know I also will be able to do it. So he's placing his confidence in others. So that means we should have confidence. Not pride, but confidence in the process. And not be negative about, well, I don't know. I don't know if I can trust myself. Well, Prabhu, you know, I'm not that sincere. Or sometimes we say, will you do this? And you say, I'll try. But from Prabhupada's perspective, there's certain things we don't try. There's certain things we just do. And to say, I'll try, is kind of reinforcing a doubt. But some things in Krishna consciousness, we can't say, I'll try. We just have to say, yes, this is what I'm going to do, because it's part of the process. And I want to affirm to myself that I'm doing the process, so therefore I do it. Right? So just try to catch you. I'm just bringing this up because a lot of times, as I said, devotees will say, how do I do this? When the answer is, you just do it. There is no other answer. And asking, how do I do it, is kind of a negative. It's, there's something wrong with asking the question. Because sometimes we shouldn't ask that question. We should just know, I just have to do it. How do you control your mind? How do you control your senses? What's the secret? Okay, ultimately we say the secret is be Krishna conscious. We know that. All right, that's the secret. But even to do that, you have to do it. And even to be Krishna conscious, you have to control your mind and senses. You see? So it's like, how do I control my mind and senses? Be Krishna conscious. How can I be Krishna conscious? Control your mind and senses. So you can't get around it. Right? There's always this, you know, there's always a point where it just relies on us to do it. We have to do it. It just doesn't go, there's no one else to push us up. So sometimes, as I was saying before, we can get in kind of an artificial dependence mode where we become too dependent on another, on the mercy of Guru or the devotees, and we don't exert our own willpower to the degree that we need to. And say, well, you know, by mercy, I'll be able to do it. That's true, but not entirely. So there's a healthy degree of dependence, and there's an unhealthy degree of dependence, where you can become so dependent that you don't exert your own willpower. Only if I'm in the right perfect situation with the right sangha, etc., can I do this. We shouldn't think that way. Because what if you're not in the right situation? Then what happens? You collapse, right? Because you calculated you could only do it in a particular situation. Then you collapse. So what we're striving to come to in Krishna consciousness is the point where we don't rely as much on external situations as we rely on our own willpower, our own ability to make decisions and follow through on them, and promises, and keep those promises. It's like, imagine a situation Hari Bol, Shyam. Nice to see you. Imagine a situation that would be difficult for you to be Krishna conscious. Just think of some situation, like you had to move, your family had to move to some little town in North Dakota. There's no devotees, no ISKCON, nothing. Or maybe you had to work at a job in North Dakota and you had to be there by yourself for 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time. You think, oh, that would be difficult to be Krishna conscious. Right? Yes? You just be alone. And then you might think, oh no, if I'm alone by myself, then my mind, maybe my mind will overtake me. Maybe it'll be difficult, right? So you see what's going on? See, already we're defeating ourselves. We're already like psyching ourselves out. But the proper attitude is, as Prabhupada said to one devotee, don't ever think the you're dependent on the circumstance. To some degree it's true. We need sangha and so forth. But if we take it too far, then we'll think, well, if I don't have the right circumstance, I can't be Krishna conscious. Then we just give in. Well, in this situation, I won't be able to be Krishna conscious. So I'm flying out to North Dakota, and I've already failed before I started. You know, I've given up before I started. So that would be a mistake, right? As we were saying yesterday, that we always want to look at ourselves for a defect. So Prabhupada was saying in the same way, he said, don't think that the circumstance is entirely what determines your Krishna consciousness. But think that it's you, your own devotion, your own sincerity. That's what determines your Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, if you don't have the right situation, then what do? Quit? Okay, let's quit. I give up. I can't do it. That wouldn't be smart, would it? You want to hear a funny story about faith? This is such a good story. Should I tell you? Because I think a lot of what we're talking about here is faith. It's okay. I may not drink that much. I think a lot of what we're talking about here is faith, both in the process and faith in our own integrity to follow the process, like both things. So here's a nice story about faith. You all know the Grand Canyon. You must seen pictures of the Grand Canyon or been there, right? So this one man did a tightrope walk across the Grand Canyon. Put the tightrope. I don't know, how deep is the canyon? Anybody know? Anyone have a figure? What? 16,000 feet, which is like 3 miles, right? So that's a long fall, 3 miles. So after he got to the other side, a person saw him and they said, you know, you should go back carrying a wheelbarrow. And the man said, you want me to go across carrying a wheelbarrow? And they said, yeah. He said, do you think I could do it? And they said, definitely, you could do it. He said, you really think I could do it? He said, oh yeah, I'm sure you can do it. There's no question. And the person said, in fact, I have a wheelbarrow. So he got the wheelbarrow. He said, okay, get in. Let's go. So you have so much faith. Are you ready to? You understand? The person saying you can cross a tightrope, you know what a tightrope is? Said you can cross a tightrope with a wheelbarrow. You know a wheelbarrow? So the person is telling him, encouraging them, you can do this, I have faith in you. So he said, okay, get in the wheelbarrow, let's go. Let's go across a tightrope. You have so much faith in me, so get in the wheelbarrow. So it's kind of like talking about how Krishna consciousness works, but then you actually have to have faith in it. Faith in yourself and faith in the process, both. And not a negative, I don't know how to do this, I don't know if I can do it, it's too difficult, I'm too lazy. Even if you say, sometimes devotees say, I'm too lazy. Okay, maybe that's true. But if you want to achieve something, if you really want something, you don't sit around and say, I'm too lazy, do you? I mean, think about it. When do you say I'm too lazy? When something is difficult to do and maybe not ultimately that important for you, then you could say, well, I'm too lazy. But when something's important to us, we never say I'm too lazy. Do we? No, because we want it. So it's just, you know, we have to be a little analytical and open and honest about what we're saying. What does I'm too lazy mean? It means I don't care. It means the goal is not that important or inspiring to me that I care enough to stop being lazy. Okay, maybe you are lazy. But if you are lazy, and that laziness is getting in the way of being Krishna conscious, wouldn't you think it's a good idea to stop being lazy? Wouldn't that make sense? Makes sense to me. I'll tell you something about Prabhupada. When a devotee would make a mistake, and Prabhupada wanted to see how they would rectify the mistake, what they would do. He wasn't so concerned that the mistake was made. Of course, devotees would apologize. He wasn't even so concerned about the apology. He was more concerned about what will we do now, or what you will do now. It was always move forward. It was always, we're moving in service to Krishna forward. So how can we continue to move forward? That was Prabhupada's mood. So obstacles come, mistakes are made, you continue to move. What will we do now? How do we go forward? So that should be the way we think, moving forward. How do we move forward? I fell, I made a mistake. Okay, how do I move forward from here? Not, I'm so useless, what's the point? If I try again, I'll fail. No, that's never the way Prabhupada dealt with anyone. If it's just like Prabhupada gave us so much service, and he was very, very happy when we would achieve results in our preaching work. And so none of Prabhupada's disciples would want to go to him and say, Prabhupada, I failed. And then give the reason they failed. Because they knew, in most cases, unless it was inevitable that you could not be successful, it was impossible due to things which are totally out of your control, we all knew Prabhupada would not accept an excuse. So what we wanted to give him was a result. This is what we did, even in spite of the difficulties and the obstacles, because it was so important to us, because we wanted to please him. And we wouldn't dare want to go to him and make an excuse, because we know he wouldn't accept it. But we make excuses to ourselves, don't we? You ever made an excuse to yourself for failing? Or not doing your best? Or not achieving something you really could achieve? Have you ever done that? We've all done that. Yes? So it was very good training that Prabhupada gave us. I mean, really, what Prabhupada was doing, if you study the history of the movement, he was doing one impossible thing after another. And one of the most impossible things he was doing is he was doing the impossible things with people who are not qualified to do the impossible, and they were doing the impossible. Right? It was like impossible on all levels. But somehow or other, because Prabhupada was so anxious to spread Krishna consciousness and so determined to do it, and somehow the impossible just didn't, it was never in our minds, in his mind, the impossible was not a consideration. And I think that's why devotees achieved so much success in their own spiritual lives. Because they had a mission impossible, so their level of Krishna consciousness had to be very high to do mission impossible. So it was this whole level of consciousness where nobody would allow themselves to be deterred by the so-called obstacles, which there were many. There were plenty of obstacles all the time. So it just shows how a shift in consciousness can produce such wonderful results. Have you ever wondered how the movement spread so rapidly? So few qualified people? When I joined the movement, in 1969 I came. I looked in the BTG because I wanted to see how many temples there were in 1969. I think there were 18 temples, 15 or 18 temples. Based on the average number of devotees in a temple at that time, I calculated there were 300 devotees in ISKCON when I joined. Maybe. I don't even think there were that many. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that funny? You go to a class at some festival, there's 1,000 devotees. You go on your yatras, there are 5,000 devotees. When I joined, the total number worldwide was maybe 300. And then I looked in the BTG for next year, and there were 35 temples. And then when Prabhupada left, there were 108 temples. So a lot was going on. And that doesn't include all the projects. So how was it going on? It was going on against, I would say, against all odds, by Prabhupada's desire. We have to push it on. That's it. So it's always nice to meditate on this and to understand that this is our history in ISKCON. This is what it was founded on. It was founded on people doing impossible things. Go to London to meet the Beatles. That was impossible. And it happened. Look what Prabhupada did in India. No one has done what Prabhupada has done in India. Look how many people. Look how many brahmacharis there are in India. That's inconceivable. 1970, Prabhupada couldn't make one brahmachari. Now, They have so many brahmacharis joining, they don't even have room for all of them. And they're not coming from the village. They're coming from IIT and other colleges. Isn't that amazing? Who would have ever thought? Another impossible task. You take hippies 7 years later after Prabhupada leaves, or 10 years after he comes. For many of those people, it's only 6 or 7 years after they join, they become guru. That's definitely impossible. In fact, it was impossible for some of them, but not for all. And some of them did well. Twenty-year-olds going out around the world and opening temples, who've been devotees 1 year, 8 months, a year and a half. Another impossible task. 5, 6 years later, big mansions all throughout Europe, 35 or 50 temples in America. When Prabhupada left, hundreds of devotees in many of our temples. How was it happening? Not by doubtful people, not by negative, not with negative people. Not with, I don't know if I can do this. It's people who were, let's do it. We're going to do it. That's it. That was the consciousness. Both in their own lives and in their work in giving Krishna to others. So, sometimes we just have to do it. Prabhupada would give devotees assignments that they've never done before. And he wouldn't explain how to do it. Get this book published. Do this, do that. Print a magazine, right? Develop a magazine. Never done that. Never had anything to do with books. Open a temple. Manage this project. Never managed anything. Okay, Prabhupada, we'll do it. And it happened. Maybe we didn't do it so well, but at least we tried. And something happened. I went to Vancouver, 1970. There were three other devotees there beside myself. And what did I know about running a temple? But by the enthusiasm of the devotees there, within a year, a year and a half, 15 new people came and joined the temple. We had no organized program for them to join, no training program, nothing. Just some desire and some enthusiasm. I didn't think, I'm only 20. Who am I to run this temple? Who am I to train these people? I thought, this is what Prabhupada wants, let's do it. We'd go on television. What do I know about, I'm 20 years old, what do I know about speaking on television? It didn't matter. We'd just do it, speaking on radio. I was 19 giving lectures in colleges on Krishna consciousness, universities. The college dropout is back teaching the university classes. We didn't think, well, I'm a college dropout, I can't do this. I said, no, these were opportunities, we took advantage. Sometimes we just have to do it. Oftentimes Prabhupada would, we'd say, how do we do this? Prabhupada would say, you do that, Krishna will guide you. He'll give you intelligence. That was the only instruction we got, that Krishna will give you intelligence. Okay, here goes. Should we do that today? Not always. We did make mistakes. We should, as far as possible, it's helpful to be trained. But still, that's what we were dealing with at that time. And many wonderful things happened. So, any questions on this topic? Any doubts? Any comments? Any arguments? Someone's going to raise their hand and say, but. Sometimes I give a class like this, and then somebody raises their hand and they say, but. And I say, but is a very bad word. Because you know what comes when you say but? You know what comes after but? What comes after but is your excuse why you can't do it. Think about it. Prabhu, what you said is very nice, but here comes the excuse. Right? So we don't say but we acknowledge there may be a difficulty, there may be an obstacle, it's not easy, we acknowledge that. But means you give into it. So you say and instead of but. Prabhu, what you said is very nice, and I have these obstacles. Okay, you'll deal with them, that's and. But means I give into the obstacle. Right? I think another important factor is not even the consideration of success, but just the consideration of the effort. If there's a reluctance to do something, that's important. If there's a reluctance to do something, that's necessary. If there's a reluctance to do something, that's needed. If there's a reluctance to do something because we're fearful, just the effort itself is so important. Despite the result, it's the effort. You know, because sometimes we're afraid to do something because we fear there'll be no result, or we fear we could fail tremendously, or maybe the result won't be adequate, or in some cases, we're even afraid we might be too successful and we don't have the infrastructure to handle the success. Like, right now, what if your preaching was really successful and 10 people said, I want to become devotees, and they're all single? You wouldn't know what to do with them. Where are you going to put them, in your house? So sometimes there may be a fear that maybe I'll become successful and I won't be able to deal with the success. Or maybe I'll become proud if I'm successful. So I think it's important for us sometimes to just focus on the fact that we need to make the effort, the endeavor, and that Krishna will be happy with that. Okay, I'm afraid to do this. We'll do it anyway. Krishna will be pleased. Even if there's no result, you just do it. And be attached to the effort. Isn't that what the Gita is all about? Isn't that what Krishna told Arjuna? Don't be attached to succeeding. Don't worry about failing. And so often we're attached to succeeding, or we're worried about failing. So no, just fight. I'll take care of everything. So that's also part of the process of Krishna consciousness. I may be reluctant to do something for whatever reason, but I should be attached to the effort. Just like Prabhupada, he felt that he was successful because he came to America. He didn't feel that he was successful because he was successful externally. But he felt he was successful because that was the order of his guru. And if he didn't come, he wouldn't be following the order. So even if he came But if he came, and even if he failed, at least he failed executing the order. So that would have been success. Okay, he came, he could discover the Americans don't want Krishna consciousness. We can't spread it here. But he was successful because he executed the order of his guru. That's all. So that's part of the just do it. Okay, but just do it even if you fail. It's okay. That was the great success. Prabhupada came to America. He just showed up. I mean, you look at, I don't know if you know the history of Prabhupada going to Russia. How many of you know the history? Prabhupada going to Russia. Only one of you? Prabhupada went to Russia during the communist regime, and his trip was very restricted. It was controlled. He couldn't publicly do programs. So he met one for his, I think the work he did in Russia, his preaching work, was just with one professor who turned out to be an atheist. So that was really useless. And as far as I remember the story, Prabhupada's servant, Shyamasundar, went out shopping, and he met somebody. I don't know if he's wearing a dhoti or not, but he met somebody that seemed interested, or one or two boys. And he brought the boys back to meet Prabhupada. I guess even that was illegal in those days. So he brought them back to the hotel, and Prabhupada spoke to these boys, either one or two. And one became so inspired that he took up Krishna consciousness, and he began preaching. And so the whole preaching work in Russia evolved from this one boy's preaching. And then I think as it evolved, they were just taking books and by hand writing them or passing them one person. They'd each read the book, give it to a friend, or both of those things. So after Prabhupada left Russia and he came back, it looked pretty uneventful. Nothing really happened. But he went there and made the effort, and look what eventually happened. So you never know. It was an opportunity. So he went there, spoke to one person, and the whole movement spread. And Russia now has about 50 temples. Did you know that? It's huge. There's thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of devotees. I think next to India, Russia is the biggest preaching in the world. Maybe Russia and China and India. But the Russians are not Indians. It's Russians that are joining. So it's nice to be in this mood. Well, this is the service, let me do it. I do it well, I do it. I don't do it well, I try my best. I'm attached to doing it as best I can. And the results may or may not be there. Then it becomes very blissful. Just like before I give class tonight, I could say, Vishalakshi, you give class. And she's like, I can't give class. I said, no, it doesn't matter if you can give class or not. Just do it as a service. So if she goes in the consciousness that I'm doing this as a service, then it won't matter if it's a good class or not. She can be very relaxed and say, okay, this is a service. Mahatma wants me to speak, so I'll speak something. That's all. So Vishalakshi, you can come now. I won't make you do it yet. Maybe in a couple of years. You can practice. Get yourself ready. But many of the services that Prabhupada gave us were like that. You know, things we hadn't done. We'll just do it. Get guidance. Krishna will guide you. Be sincere. Okay. That's it. I have to check here on Krishna.com if anybody's here with questions or comments. So the devotee's asking a question here. When preaching, I understand my words will not be perfect for each person. What is a remedy for this? Read more, chant more, study Prabhupada's books. This is all good advice, great advice. I understand. I will not succeed perfectly. Keep preaching. Krishna will give you the knowledge you need. Yes, that's the answer. He's saying, you know, like when we joined ISKCON, at that time, the daily schedule in most temples was that after we do the morning program, we'd have breakfast, we'd clean the temple. So like around 10 or 11, we would go out on the street and do Harinam Sankirtan. And we would distribute back to guided magazines. So after we would do kirtan 15, 20 minutes, we'd stop. And usually there were some people watching, so we'd give a little talk. Some people would distribute magazines. So you know, you've been in the movement a few weeks, a month. Okay, it's your turn. You give the talk. We're not these bodies. We're part and parcel of Krishna. We're all servants. You know, we heard these things over and over. So we give our little talk. Okay. You've been a devotee now 6 months. It's time you give Bhagavad Gita class. Oh, I've never given Bhagavad Gita class. Okay. You give Bhagavad Gita class now. That's how it all started. It's time for you. You're now a Brahmin. It's time for you to cook for the deities. But I don't know how to cook. That's okay. How do I learn to cook? Prabhu, this is how you learn to cook. You go into the kitchen, pay obeisances, and pray to Krishna. Please guide me how to cook. That's your first cooking class. Seriously. Seriously. This is how many devotees learn to cook. How do we learn to distribute books? Go out and begin talking. Just tell people something. You want to know a secret, how I learned to give lectures? Should I tell you? This is really interesting way that I learned. Amongst other things, one of the things I used to do when I was alone, particularly when I would be driving alone, I would give a lecture. And I would create a lecture from all the things that I would tell people when I was a young devotee, when I was on the street, was we would distribute back to Godheads, and I would tell them something. And like every day I would tell them something different. So I had, you know, one day I would say the same thing to everybody. So by the end of the day it was really clear how to say it. Then the next day I would say something else. The next day I'd say something else. So yeah, after like 30 days I had like a whole lecture, you know. It was really easy for me to speak. So then when I'd be driving somewhere, I'd put it all together and give a lecture just to myself in the car. That's how I learned to give lectures. On the street, speaking to people, then putting it together, and then I'd give the lecture in the car. Because I knew I was going to have to do it. So I didn't think, I can't do it, I don't know how to do it. I made the assumption, which was true, that I'm going to have to do this because everybody was doing it anyway. We were all doing it. So you see the mood of the movement? It was just like everybody's doing all these things, so you just accepted it. So it was very empowering. So Jai Rupa's saying, do I just go out and preach? Of course, you learn as best you can, you hear from others, but you go out and Krishna guides you, and you pray to Krishna that you can say the right thing to the particular person you're speaking to, because everybody's different. And not necessarily can you say, do you want to say the same thing to everybody? Right? Um, What if somebody feels they do not have much to say? Well, most devotees' experience is that when you begin telling someone about Krishna, you realize you have more to say than you thought. You know more than you thought. And one of the wonderful things about teaching is that Krishna uses you as a mouthpiece. So sometimes you say something that you didn't realize you knew, or perhaps you didn't even realize it till you spoke it. And sometimes you watch yourself speaking and you're listening to yourself as if you're listening to someone else, because Krishna's using you as his mouthpiece. So that's wonderful. Wonderful experience. Every devotee who preaches has this experience. I once gave a class in Vrindavan. Then after I gave the class, I knew I could never give that class again. It was just, something came through me. It was a one-time affair. And in those times, I always think, did somebody record this? Because I want to listen to what I said. Because it wasn't me speaking. So that's the that's a really blissful aspect of Krishna consciousness, when Krishna is using you as an instrument. And you're either preaching with realization you didn't know you had, or you're managing with intelligence you didn't realize you had, or you're helping and guiding others with insight you didn't realize you had. Because if you want to be an instrument, Krishna has to use you, so he works through you. Right? If you're willing, Krishna, I'm willing, please use me. Okay. All right. I'll use you. Let's go. And you can actually feel that. You can feel Krishna's guidance. It's very, very blissful. Again, the movement was started by very young devotees, but being empowered. So, Ajinkya says, I have experienced that sometimes we just have to say nothing. Krishna wants us only to try. He's already doing it. The person is fascinated by Krishna consciousness from inside. Sometimes you just have to show up. Be a good devotee. When the devotees first went to India, he said, Prabhupada, we don't speak the language. Prabhupada said, it doesn't matter. They don't care. Just by seeing you, that's preaching. Right? And all your Indians, right? What does every Indian say when they meet a Western devotee? They all say the same thing. You're teaching our culture. We're not even living it like you are. And they all feel embarrassed. And it's a real impetus for them to become Krishna conscious. So, anything else? Pallavi is asking about the book I mentioned yesterday. It's called Many Moons. M-O-O-N-S. She thought it was called Many Movies. Many Moves. No, Many Moons. About the lives of departed ISKCON devotees. Departed Vaishnavas in ISKCON. Yeah, you should all get the book. I don't know where. Krishna.com probably will have it. Girashami wrote the book. Maybe he has facility, but it's very inspiring. Hear about the lives of so-called ordinary devotees, and you'll see how extraordinary they were. You'd like to hear a story from the book? Jayananda Prabhu had leukemia and he went to Tijuana, which is the border of San Diego. It's called Baja California. It's considered Mexico. And they could do treatments in Mexico that were illegal in America, natural treatments. So he was in this hospital getting very inspired because he had a lot of time to read. He was always very busy and active, and at this point he had more time to read than he ever had in his life, and he was getting so many realizations from reading. And then he would go around and preach to people in the hospital, and then he would go have his Bhagavad Gita classes. So he's really, really inspired and really Krishna conscious. And he was getting a little better, it seemed. And at some point the hospital said, you can't preach in the hospital, you can't do this. So he told the devotees, I'm leaving. He said, if I can't preach, what's the use of being here? You know, dying, getting cured, and there's no use of being here. And he left. And he went to San Diego, and then he went to Los Angeles to die. He said, he gave up the fight. That's an American person who joined in America with that consciousness. Isn't that amazing? Want to hear another story? One devotee, I believe she had cancer, so her Guru Maharaj said, go to Vrindavan to die. So she went to Vrindavan to die, and she got better. She didn't take any medication, just by being in Vrindavan. Okay. Prabhu, when you speak about Prabhupada, it is so evident that you love him so much and he traveled so much all the time. You could not have been able to be with him always. How did you accept that? Well, I think firstly it was a reality that Prabhupada had so many disciples that just it was not possible that many could be with him always. And if you weren't a GBC or a temple president or a sannyasi, you didn't have much access to Prabhupada. So I think many of us really, we accepted that and we got association when we could, but we really associated with him through service and also through his books. And of course it was through our godbrothers and godsisters because we were all disciples. And I could say, honestly say, that it's a synergistic experience. Synergistic meaning it wasn't only Prabhupada that was helping us. We were helped by so many devotees, but they were helped by Prabhupada. So because of Prabhupada, they could help us. So I could honestly say that so many of my godbrothers helped me in ways, I don't know how to say this, it sounds offensive, help me in ways that Prabhupada didn't, or maybe circumstantially couldn't, because they were in front of me, so they could chastise me. Where Prabhupada, I wasn't in front of him, so he couldn't chastise me. But they couldn't chastise me and help me unless Prabhupada was our guru. So then I could say, well, Prabhupada was chastising me through them, or helping me through them. So we felt it that way. We never felt it separate. So there was a synergy. You had Prabhupada, you had his disciples. Together, the parts were greater than the individuals. Sometimes I go places, and devotees say, I stay at their home, and they say, whoa, it was like I felt, when you were staying at my home, I felt it was like my Guru Maharaj was staying. I see you in him. Which was just not I think, which is kind of natural if we're both disciples of Prabhupada. There may be some similarities. I take it as a compliment, of course, that they would say that. But we're all part of the same family, so you can feel your spiritual master through other people that are like him. And we felt very close to Prabhupada through his books, because his books were his instructions to us. ISKCON was Prabhupada's movement, so we felt very close to Prabhupada, spreading ISKCON. That was his mission, that's what he gave us. So there was this deep connection. And we still feel that. And when there's trouble in ISKCON, we want to solve a problem. That is a connection with Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, in separation, you think of the person more. And on the absolute plane, thinking of the person, you're with the person. And I think a lot of us felt that it was our service to be separated from Prabhupada, because if we just followed him around everywhere, then we wouldn't be doing our service. So it would be kind of like sense gratification. So, but we did, you know, Prabhupada did stay in Mayapur and Vrindavan for Gaur Purnima, so we could all go there and be with him every day. He would give class and we could hear, could be with him for a month. He spent many, many months in Los Angeles. I was there 3 months. Prabhupada was there. Many devotees felt that if they just spent a few days with Prabhupada, that would be enough for the next year. Because the mood was to serve. So I think in ISKCON also, we're one family, and there's so many, you have your guru, and there's so many uncles, other disciples of Prabhupada, and aunts. So it's not, you know, some devotees are more trained by their temple presidents or other siksha gurus than they are by their guru, because they don't have that access. But they see it all as their guru is training them through the other person. They see it as all one. That's just the nature of our organization, that most gurus can't personally train all their disciples. I mean, the gurus who have a lot of disciples, they can't personally train them. Other people are training. But you see your guru through that training. And then I think also there was a sense of just wanting to be with Prabhupada. There was like a sense of when it was helpful and when it would no longer be helpful. Like it would just be kind of like, it would turn into sense gratification. You know, because being with Prabhupada was like the highest thing. I mean, you could just like look at him nonstop and just drink the nectar. So, you know, there's a story. And Prabhupada was in his garden in Los Angeles, and he was sitting with the sannyasis, and then one of the main book distributors went out on book distribution, and Prabhupada was talking about them, and he said, he's doing more service than all of you. You're sitting here with me, but he's going out. So there was that sense also of service. You know, if I'm just sitting with Prabhupada, it's kind of like transcendental sense gratification. But the real service, the mission, is to go out and do what he's asking of us. So I think many devotees felt that, you know, it was good to get Prabhupada's association, but at a certain point, enough was enough. Then it would just become kind of like a personal enjoyment type thing. We all want to be with our gurus, no doubt. But serving their mission is the most important. Now, if a devotee was having trouble, sometimes Prabhupada would say, then come travel with me. Maybe let them travel. I mean, if it was a more highly placed devotee, Prabhupada would say, you can come with me and travel. So he would actually take them, they would come on the party and they would get inspired by Prabhupada. Then at a certain point, we'd say, okay. Now, in the beginning of the movement, when all the devotees were very young, they were very dependent on Prabhupada. And Prabhupada came, he started ISKCON. Can you imagine? ISKCON is Prabhupada, that's all it is. And he leaves New York to go to San Francisco. How would you feel? But the devotees did the same things that Prabhupada was doing, and they felt his presence. Although it was traumatic when he left. But after they continued the kirtans and classes, and they felt his presence in those programs and those instructions. So you feel the presence of your guru in service, just like I have so many god brothers, and when I'm with them, so much of Prabhupada comes through them, so that I feel I'm with Prabhupada. I see Prabhupada through them. I feel closer to Prabhupada through them. So same thing, you can, so many devotees, you might see your Guru Maharaj through them. Or something coming through them that reminds you of him. So you feel close that way. And the Prabhupada said, we're never separated. We're always together. Because it's absolute. Service is absolute. Instruction is absolute. Instruction is not different from the Guru. Where the holy name is, Krishna is there. Where Krishna is, all his devotees are there. When we're chanting, we're all together. These are things Prabhupada said. Of course, the personal association is special. There's no doubt about it. But it's not always there. But what is always there is the instruction. And her reply was, tough medicine. Sweet. I don't think we ever thought it was tough. Because we felt Prabhupada so much through his disciples. Just like, if your spiritual master wants you to do something and you do it, you feel his presence. Or even if he doesn't want you to do something, but you know he would want you to do it because he does it. Or you act in a way that you know he would want you to act. Or you act in a way that he acts. You feel his presence. Maybe there's a quarrel and you just tell the person, I'm sorry. Because you know your Guru Maharaj would want you to do that. You'll feel very close to him, right? And then we also have so many Siksha Gurus. So when we're away from our Guru, there's so many Siksha Gurus helping us. She's very attached to being with her guru. So she said, tough medicine. Pallavi, I may be coming to your house in a few days, so don't worry. Hare Krishna. Anything else? Yes?
Can you send me a dumb, because I'm dumb. I have a question. What's this matter with the mood? Always Gauravani, they released millions of moods.
Yeah.
Here also, life of moods. Why do we compare devotees with the moon?
Oh, well, in the book that Giriraswami wrote called Millions of Moons, he was quoting Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, you know, Prabhupada quoted Chanakya. You know, the Chanakya said, what's the use of many stars? Because if you have one moon, it'll light up the whole sky, but many stars will not. So Prabhupada said, if I can make one of my disciples a pure devotee, then I'll consider my mission successful, because he's the one moon, and from him, Krishna consciousness will spread, just as Prabhupada is the moon that spread Krishna consciousness around the world. So then Giriraj Swami was saying, by Prabhupada's grace, he made more than one moon. He made many moons. And this book is therefore called Many Moons, in the life of the disciples of Prabhupada. And the greatness of his disciples is just the glorification of Prabhupada, because it's they're all reflections of Prabhupada, or they're reflections of their gurus who are disciples of Prabhupada. So it's all glorious. And that's one of the things you get from this book, is that the reflection of Prabhupada's mercy coming through Prabhupada's disciples to their disciples. And so we can all become moons, at least potentially. And the other example of moons, Lord Nityananda, his lotus feet are like millions of moons, soothing. So the idea of the moon is it's soothing, and we're burning in the fire of material existence. And Lord Nityananda's mercy is like moonshine, relieving the burning fire of material existence. So his mercy is like thousands of moons or millions of moons, cooling. You feel very close to your guru when you serve his mission. Or particularly just serving within ISKCON is the mission of every guru. So you feel very, when you're, especially, the mission is to give other people Krishna. So you feel very close to your guru when you give other people Krishna. You feel, if you're not initiated, you don't have a guru, you feel very close to Prabhupada when you give other people, because that's Krishna, because that's Prabhupada's mission. And you can feel very close to your guru when you live Krishna consciousness, because he wants you to live Krishna consciousness. He wants you to act in a Krishna conscious way. I was just reading in this book, Many Moons, it has a section on Sridhar Swami. So Sridhar Swami, he taught about communication and cooperation, and he once told his disciples, he said, he wanted them to personify humility. He said, I want you to be known as being humble. He said, I want my disciples to be known as being humble. So if you're his disciple, then simply by acting humbly, you'll feel connected, because that was the instruction he gave. Right? Specifically, I want you to be known as the humble devotees, the ones that always get along with everybody. So then by getting along, by being humble, you're doing service to your guru. And you feel close, because you know this is what he wanted you to do. When I do the japa workshops, I see how much it helps the devotees, and I always feel very close to Prabhupada when it's over. I felt like Prabhupada was happy I did this, because it's helping devotees so much. It's so much needed. So I feel that. Smiling, Prabhupada smiling, happy. So this association, it's not material, it's transcendental. So you can have it, even though you're not physically present. Then what to speak, what do you do when your guru leaves? They're saying, so Pallavi is saying, but what about personal association? Well, already so many gurus have left. Gaura Govinda Maharaj has left. Tamal Krishna Maharaj has left. Who else? Sridhar Maharaj has left. Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj has left. What do the disciples do now? They don't have personal association. What do they do? The instructions, the service, and they find others who they feel represent their guru. They feel a connection to another person. They somehow see their guru there. Right? It's like, you know. I mean, most of our gurus in ISKCON are older. And, you know, you don't know. You get initiated tomorrow, you don't know how long your guru is going to live. So, you know, like with us,
I was with Prabhupada for 7 years. Not even seven. 77. Yeah. Maybe not even seven. 6 and a half. Almost seven. It's not long, is it? And, you know, people getting initiated today. Maybe you don't know. Maybe 10 years, maybe 5, maybe 20, you don't know. Maybe 3, it's hard to say. Then what will you do? You get initiated 3 years later, your Guru Maharaj leaves, has an accident, whatever. Now what? You have to spend the rest of your life without your Guru Maharaj. In separation, how will you deal with it? It's a good question, isn't it? How will we deal with it? Through serving his instructions, through associating with his godbrothers, taking shelter of them, through associating with the other godbrothers and godsisters. So we can't be entirely overly dependent on the personal association because it's not going to be here. I mean, it's so difficult. It can be very difficult to be separated from one's guru. It can be even more difficult when the guru leaves. So we have to learn how to appreciate the presence in separation and through the instruction. It's so important. Yes? I mean, it's, you know, I mean, from a material calculation, you could say, why don't we make gurus who are in their 40s? Because that way they'll be around for 20, 30, 40 years. And they're initiating, you know, 20-year-olds. So that's good. They'll be together a long time. But, you know, the 60s and 70-year-old gurus initiating the 20-year-olds, you don't know. Not that the 40-year-olds are qualified necessarily, but it's just, you know, sometimes I think about that. You know, it's very, very trying when the spiritual master leaves. It's difficult enough when he's here, right? Being separated. And not having personal association, getting personal instruction, dealing with personal problems. That's all difficult. The Prabhupada spoke a lot about it. In fact, in that book, Many Moons, their letters are quoted where Prabhupada talks about it. So you get the book. I actually could have brought, there's a person in Alachua was selling them. I could have brought a bunch. I didn't think. Next time. But I did bring something. I did remember to bring these. Somebody's after me here. Probably my daughter. Hare Krishna. I'm giving class now on Krishna.com. Now I'm advertising my CD. This is called Everything Mahatma. That's okay. You're going to go to sleep now? Okay. You want to say hello to everybody? Want to say Hare Krishna? Want to say Hare Krishna to everybody? Wait a second. Okay, say Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
You hear everybody?
Yeah. Are you on Skype?
No, we're on the phone. You didn't hear them?
On the phone?
Yeah.
Okay,
they're going to say Hare Krishna again.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Hare Bol. Yeah, so everything I recorded over since 1986 is on here, 13 hours of music. 25 songs never heard before. 4 hours of live kirtan never heard before. There's even songs for children in English called Songs for Krishna's Kids, if you like. They're there if you'd like to give a donation. I don't mind. Hare Krishna. Okay, yeah. Next time I come, I'll bring the book. Such a nice book. So, we should have some kirtan? Is that all right? Okay. We're going to have kirtan, everyone. I have to hold on a second and turn the volume down here. Krishna Govinda Hari Murari. Oh, yeah, okay. Mridango. I'll play this one.